This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
Yeah, people wonder a lot about the new evangelization.
You're re-evangelizing the de-Christianized.
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
The vast number of Catholics have been sacramentalized but not evangelized.
I'm talking about God, the devil, hell, heaven!
To be Catholic is to evangelize.
He's absolutely right.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Al, it's always a joy to be with you.
What is your quest?
Build the church, bless the nation.
We are go for launch.
10, 9.
I just want to tell you both, good luck. We're all counting on you.
Let's do this.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining us. We've got another hour here to talk about the things that matter most. CNN has started a series called Finding Jesus. I've mentioned it a few times this week. Its first episode was last Sunday, I believe, and it took a look at the Shroud of Turin and the Sudarium of Orvieto. We had an earlier conversation with Dr. John Jackson, who was appeared on the program, but it was much too short an interview, and so I asked Dr. Jackson to join me later this week, and today is the day. Dr. Jackson is director of the Turin Shroud Center of Colorado. It's engaged in quite a bit of scientific research on the Shroud. They are doing work there on how the image was formed on the Shroud. They're also looking at the hypothesis that carbon monoxide accumulation on the Shroud was responsible for an erroneous radiocarbon dating of the Shroud. They're also looking at the Shroud in light of first century Jewish and Roman, in light of the Jewish and Roman world, for instance. What kind of pollen existed in that first century? Is it a different pollen that than was in the environment, say, in the 9th century? What kind of practices in the crucifixion? Did those crucifixion practices change as the centuries went by? So they're doing quite a bit in looking at the Shroud and trying to come up with scientific and scholarly evidence that explains exactly what we're dealing with here. So it is not only, of course, a relic that people are highly committed to and are devoted to, but it's also an empirical object which begs for scientific research and understanding. So Dr. Jackson joining me. Also, we saw the recent passing of Leonard Nimoy, the great Spock from Star Trek. Star Trek will go down in television history as one of the most influential programs that ever produced, and it went on not only for one generation, but into second and third generations, feature films, all kinds of gear, cults were formed around Star Trek. We're going to ask why. What did it do? Why was it so effective? Did Gene Roddenberry have any idea when he came up with Star Trek that it would become the kind of cultural phenomenon that it did? And Stephen Gradonis, creator of DecentFilms.com, will be joining us. In fact, I should mention, too, they've newly designed. There's a whole redesign over there at DecentFilms.com, so we'll tell you a little bit about that as well. But Stephen will be joining us to talk about the passing of Leonard Nimoy and the influence of Star Trek and why it matters to Catholics. But first, we get to today's headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you very much, Al. Welcome, everyone. This is your Ave Maria radio news for Thursday, March 5th. It is the feast of St. John Joseph of the Cross, and today's news is sponsored in part by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. ISIS has beheaded another Coptic Christian in Libya. Mansour Awad was a worker on a poultry farm. The news broke as Coptic Orthodox Patriarch Tewodros II met with the families of the 21 Christians murdered last week. The patriarch gave death certificates to the families of the victims, certifying their martyrdom. Four American Catholic Catholic publications with widely diverging editorial perspectives have joined in a call for abolition of the death penalty in the U.S. The editors of the National Catholic Register, the National Catholic Reporter, Our Sunday Visitor, and America have urged their readers to, quote, stand with us and say capital punishment must end, end quote. Their joint editorial statement appeared today on the websites of all four publications. Pope Francis enjoys broad popularity in the U.S. That, according to a new public opinion survey from the Pew Research Center, this is a February poll, and it found that 70% of the American public view the Pope favorably. Among Catholics, 90% view him favorably. Those figures rival the peak popularity ratings for John Paul II in the 90s. The Pope's popularity ratings are consistently in every category measured in a breakdown of the Pew results: men and women, old and young, political, conservatives, and liberals. His highest rating, 95% favorable, is among Catholics who attend Mass weekly. Port Authority officials say two people are hospitalized with minor injuries after a Delta jet skidded off the runway this morning at New York's LaGuardia Airport.
The aircraft was carrying 127 passengers and five crew members. Happily, there are only minor injuries that have been reported. We believe two passengers have been transported to hospitals. That number may change.
Spokesman Pat Foy says the National Transportation Safety Board will be investigating. The nose of the MD-88 could be seen up against a fence on the edge of Flushing Bay. The runway had been plowed shortly before the accident, and two planes landing before the Delta jet had reported good braking action. The Port Authority confirms there was a minor fuel leak after the accident, but it is now under control. And former New York Archbishop Edward Egan has died at the age of 82. Cardinal Egan presided over the Archdiocese of New York from 2000 to 2009 after serving for 12 years as the Bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut. He was a visible Catholic leader, invoking prayers for justice after 9/11 and escorting Pope Benedict XVI during his 2008 visit. And now your fascinating fact for the day. Twinkie inventor Jimmy Dewar ate more than 40,000 Twinkies in his lifetime. Cannot be good for you. For Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. As I've mentioned a few times this week, CNN has initiated a six-part series called Finding Jesus, where it will take a look at, being presented as six holy objects that tell the remarkable story of the Gospels. Last week, they looked at the Shroud of Turin and the Sudarium of Oviedo. And earlier this week, we had Dr. John Jackson join us, the director of the Turin Shroud Center of Colorado. But the interview was just too short, and we vowed to get back and see if we could spend a little more time looking at the Shroud of Turin and also get Dr. Jackson's impression of the CNN project. My guest is Dr. John Jackson, director of the Turin Shroud Center of Colorado. His team has collectively performed more than 100 man years, not man hours, 100 man years studying the Shroud. Dr. Jackson participated in the 1978 Shroud of Turin research project. He's also a member of the Equestrian Order of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, and his website is shroudofturin.com. Dr. Jackson, good to have you back. Thanks.
Yes, thank you for inviting me back.
Let's start from getting your impressions, first of all, about the CNN production. And did you like it? What would you have changed? What was your general impression of the way they treated the Shroud?
Well, I think they did actually two things. I think the presentation was tilted towards favorability to what the Shroud has to offer. And also, I think that it was, they had to incorporate into it, and they did, some pros and cons with respect to the Shroud.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think that does is, it takes the thoughtful person and brings them into themselves into the understanding of the Shroud. I don't think the Shroud is something that should be relied upon this or that expert. I think it rather, and I've always felt this way, and my wife, Rebecca, who runs our Shroud Center as well, it should be something that brings that people get engaged in themselves, and then they take it from there.
Yeah, yeah. Many people were concerned about the radiocarbon dating test. What was that, back in 1988?
Yes.
Okay. Which dated the Shroud as a medieval artifact. How do you look at that?
Well, okay. First of all, the word radiocarbon dating is the common name given to that process. However, what I prefer to say is it's a radiocarbon measurement.
Okay.
And the date, the quote date that you get, comes from a mathematical calculation of the ratios of carbon-14 to carbon-12 in the sample to give you a date. Now, that part of it is something that radiocarbon dating is based upon. Namely, there are assumptions in applying that mathematical analysis to an interpretation of the measurement. So I think we have to separate the measurement versus the interpretation of that measurement is basically what I'm trying to say. I have no reason to think that the measurement made by the three laboratories wasn't accurate, but it's in the interpretation of that is where my issue would be.
Would you question what it is that they were measuring? Were they measuring the Shroud or some sample, a polluted sample of some sort?
Well, that's part of the assumption that you have to make, because every measurement in science has assumptions, and the radiocarbon
right.
measurement or dating is no exception. But in science, we can't just take a measurement or an interpretation result and just challenge it because we just don't like it,
right?
Which is subjectivity. You have to have a reason for it, and I believe we do have reasons for seriously challenging the radiocarbon date. And if I may, I'll just give you one real quick one.
Sure, please do.
In our scientific testing that we did in 1978, in which I had the privilege of being the team leader of that, I was the president of STIRP at the time, we collected a variety of data. But one of the things that I noticed while we were there was that there were fold lines on the Shroud of Turin. They're permanent looking. And, in fact, they are permanent. You can go back to photographs of 100 years ago, and they're still there. You know,
okay.
So these things are permanent creases in the cloth. And from the analysis of those, which we recorded at that time, I asked the photographers to record it so we could analyze it later. I believe, and my colleagues think, that we have a solution to what these fold lines represent. And what they do is they dovetail very nicely with another shroud that was in Constantinople before the radiocarbon date gives to the shroud.
Hmm.
We're talking time frames of 1200s and earlier. In Constantinople, there's documented evidence, discussions of these. Also, there's images in terms of icons. And what's interesting, and this is the point, that the fold lines on the shroud dovetail very compellingly into how this cloth in Constantinople, which was believed to be the burial shroud of Jesus with an image on it, just like the Shroud of Turin, was. And so I think that the Shroud of Turin, therefore, because it has these scientific fold lines that we can measure
mm-hmm.
on it, was one and the same as this shroud that was in Constantinople. And the bottom line, then, is that for that to be true, based upon that analysis, the radiocarbon date could not be true, could not be correct. So we have, that would give us a... There's others.
Is that, let me ask, I'm not sure I understood. Is that other shroud, are you saying that that is one and the same as the Shroud of Turin, only at a different period in its history, or is that a second shroud?
Well, what I'm saying is that the shroud that we have in history in Constantinople,
yes,
has there are certain things we know about it. We know how it was presented. It's described and also given images of that, how it was presented to for the public at that time. And what I'm saying is that the Shroud of Turin, the cloth that we have in Turin, has fold lines on it, which fold the shroud up like the presentation mode that's given to us of this other documented shroud with an image on it in Constantinople. And it's pretty striking. And so I think that is a compelling reason to connect and say that the Shroud of Turin must be that same shroud in the history that was in Constantinople.
Yes. Okay. That's
right. And then a corollary that goes with that is that, therefore, the radiocarbon date that says that the shroud cloth only comes out of the 14th century, and yet we've got a 1200 and before cloth in Constantinople, the obvious result is that the radiocarbon date must not be giving us the correct result.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is why.
Right. Okay.
And that's where more research is needed.
Okay. So are you conducting research then on why? So you've got the shroud prior to the radiocarbon measurement. And so now the question is, what went wrong with the radiocarbon measurement?
Yes.
Yes.
Because
okay.
Because you... Otherwise, you'd like. I think we. This is my position on this. I think that the radiocarbon date is wrong, but the question is why is it wrong?
Right. Okay.
Radiocarbon is a physics measurement. That's my PhD is in physics.
Mm-hmm.
We need to analyze that and to close the loop, if you will.
Dr. Jackson, hold it there. We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue. My guest, Dr. John Jackson, director of the Turin Shroud Center of Colorado, he led the Shroud of Turin research project in 1978 and continues his investigation. He was in the CNN Finding Jesus series.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, your national and local online business directory, connecting Christian business professionals with Catholic consumers. Advertisers have taken a stand to support Christian family values in the marketplace. It's important to support businesses that embrace life and promote the gospel of Christ. And at CatholicBusinessPages.com, business professionals have taken that stand. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" They reply, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Then Jesus presses them, "Who do you say that I am?" The disciples try to dodge the question, responding with what other people are saying about Jesus. In our world today, does the same, calling Jesus a good teacher or a good man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some even dismiss him as a myth or a legend. But the Lord is asking us for our answer. Who do you say that I am? Not what academia, entertainment, culture, or politics have to say. You. It is your choice and your Holy Spirit-inspired answer. What do you say?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace. Power. Purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org. Underwriting by Ignatius Press.
Never have the devil, demonic possession, and exorcism been as widely discussed as they are today, and yet so few satisfactory explanations are available. Now, in the powerful film Defeating the Devil, Exorcists Tell Their Story from Ignatius Press, renowned experts including Father Gabriel Amort, official exorcist of the Diocese of Rome, talk about the devil, temptation, curses, infestation, and possession. Must viewing for anyone serious about the spiritual life. Order at 800-651-1531, Ignatius.com, or your Catholic bookstore.
Republicans, Democrats, no matter which political party is in office, there are always investment opportunities to be found. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds won't compromise the moral beliefs of its investors. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. The portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and moral values. Call toll-free 866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
Spiritus Sanctus Academy and the Dominican Sisters of Mary are pleased to announce that San Diego Chargers quarterback Philip Rivers is the St. Dominic Medal winner, the order's highest honor. He will be awarded at the 2015 SSA Scholarship Dinner Auction on Saturday, March 14th. The annual fundraiser helps the schools raise the additional financial resources needed to educate approximately 400 students and provide scholarships for families needing tuition assistance. With silent and live auction items, it is the single biggest fundraiser of the year. Items this year include a wine tasting hosted by Drs. Liz Lev and Thomas Williams at the Tar Paper Shack, a trip to Italy for two to see a special exhibition of the Shroud of Turin, or have Father Leo Paddling Hug come to your home and prepare dinner for 10. It's Saturday, March 14th at the Inn at St. John's in Plymouth. To learn more or to buy tickets, go to SpiritusSanctus.org. That's SpiritusSanctus.org. Join us to honor Philip Rivers and to continue a Catholic education for those in need.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. John Jackson, director of the Turin Shroud Center of Colorado. He led the Shroud of Turin research project in 1978 and has continued doing research on this. He also appeared in the first episode of the CNN original series Finding Jesus, in which they examine the Shroud of Turin. We were talking about why the radiocarbon measurements may not be accurate. Have you concluded why they aren't accurate? What happened in the sample or the process to make you think that measurement is not accurate?
Well, We do have several hypotheses.
Okay.
That we're taking seriously here that I think have some promise. But we have to understand something about radiocarbon dating. Fundamentally, to get the measurement, you have to destroy the sample in order to get the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of fundamental to it in the way it's done. So unless there were chemical or physical measurements of the sample before the sample was sacrificed for radiocarbon, which was not the case when the radiocarbon measurement was made, we have a situation where you have to just take the result from the labs without being able to give peer review to the actual experiment itself. I mean, there are ways around that, but in a straightforward way, that's been the condition. So it's difficult to put some science into why that radiocarbon measurement on that sample, which is no longer in existence, gave us that result.
Okay.
But there's things that can be done if we were able to go back and study the shroud again, for example, we could look at the areas around where the radiocarbon sample was taken and, you know, things of that nature. But one hypothesis that we're taking seriously here is that in the atmosphere, we have several carbon-containing components. There's carbon dioxide, which everybody knows. There's methane, but there's also carbon monoxide. Now, carbon monoxide, and I'm not talking about carbon monoxide that comes out of your car.
Okay.
I'm talking about the global level of carbon monoxide. That turns out to be heavily enriched in radiocarbon. And unarguably, the shroud had to have been exposed to the air, which contains this heavily enriched carbon monoxide component. And it turns out that if that carbon from the carbon monoxide were able to interact with the cloth in such a way as to render about 2% carbon of the total carbon content of the shroud, you could take a first century shroud and have it yield a 14th century radiocarbon date.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
2% is not very much.
I see.
And so, but the challenge then is for that hypothesis would be, are there pathways by which that carbon could get into the shroud at that level? And all it takes is one pathway to do that, and that's credible, and the game is over for radiocarbon.
I see.
So, but radiocarbon date would have to assume that there's no possibility of such a pathway to be there. So that's where it's at. But this takes, you know, some sophisticated research, takes some funding to be able to do it. And so if we could achieve that, we would like to, we're very much wanting to look at that, because that's a good hypothesis.
Okay.
Because the shroud arguably had to be exposed to the open air.
Yes. All right. Well, let's go then. Many people want to know, okay, let's just bracket the radiocarbon measurement and lay out what are other evidences that the shroud preceded the 14th century, 13th, 14th century?
Yes, that's an excellent question, just because we have a knowledge of a shroud that's in Constantinople in roughly circa about close to 1,000 years ago, that doesn't mean that it's the shroud of Jesus.
Right.
But I think the only way you can address that question is to look at what Christianity gives us concerning the burial of Jesus.
Okay.
And we do have information. It's coming through the Gospels.
Sure.
Comes through our liturgy of the Mass, for example. And there's no radiocarbon date on Christianity.
Right.
So we could look at the shroud, because what the shroud would be, if it's authentic, it would be an archaeological site on cloth where Christianity began. It began inside the tomb of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Christianity tells us about that circumstance in its Gospels and so forth. But we would have the archaeological site of that. And so the question is, does that archaeological site, is it consistent with what Christianity gives us, or is it not so?
Mm-hmm.
And particularly where this the shroud might be able to show us things that we didn't really understand, but is nevertheless consistent with Christianity. It's when that happens, and there are a number of these very intriguing places where the shroud as an archaeological site coincides with what Christianity gives us, that when that happens, those are very compelling reasons to think, gee, the shroud, this may really be the burial,
okay,
the actual burial cloth of Jesus. It would have to be for this to be true.
Okay.
I can go into that, but I don't know if we have the time.
Yeah, well, let's give me one or two of them anyways, so people can know the nature of the evidence that you're referring to.
Okay, for example, a problem that has existed in scriptural exegesis of the Gospels is you have the Gospels. The synoptics, in particular, talking about a single cloth that's brought by Joseph of Arimathea to bury Jesus.
A single cloth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yet
okay.
John talks about multiple cloths,
right.
Plural, and Luke actually transitions from a single cloth to a plural cloth when he goes from the burial narratives to the resurrection narratives.
Okay.
And the question is, why is that? And scripture scholars have concerned themselves with that problem for a long time. Well, you go to the shroud, and what we find is the shroud is actually two cloths. It's a single cloth, and then there's a side strip that's sewn back onto it. This side strip was cut off, and then it was sewn back onto the shroud.
Interesting.
Now, what I would propose then as the solution is that the synoptics are thinking of the shroud that was brought by Joseph of Arimathea before this side strip was cut off.
Mm-hmm.
Then, during the burial process, in order to complete the burial, they hacked off or cut this side strip portion away, and then they used that to wrap the shroud together.
Mm-hmm.
The shroud together, and that gives you the plural cloths. So the shroud, in an unexpected way, offers a solution to a scriptural problem that we can't really solve otherwise.
Hmm. And what was, by the way, what would have been the purpose of that second strip? Why would it have been cut off originally?
Okay, when you look at the images on how they correspond to the body, the shroud had to go over the top of the head. It's a long piece of cloth, and so it goes over the body.
Yes.
Now, In a Jewish burial, this kind of a burial, a shroud burial, is just provisional, because ultimately the bones and the remains are going to be collected and put into an ossuary for the permanent burial.
Okay.
So you want this shroud burial to be able to last for a while. It's roughly thought to be like a year.
Okay.
And so you want to wrap the body together to keep everything intact.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would be how a Jewish burial would have been conducted. And so the shroud actually has both cloths there. And by the way, when you cut this side strip off, what you do is you suddenly expose all the weft threads, the perpendicular threads, to unraveling. And so you have to put that cloth back, and of course they did. It's sewn right back onto the shroud.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
ideas like that you see that the shroud is connecting. It also connects to our mass.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the corporal that we place upon which the Eucharist has to be celebrated is understood liturgically to be the burial shroud of Jesus.
Hmm.
So when Mass is celebrated, it's being celebrated right on the burial shroud of Jesus.
Yes.
And why is that? See, and so that opens up a whole new thread of inquiry, which we've been looking at.
Hmm.
So we spent a lot of time doing this.
Well, we have about 60 seconds left. People have talked about pollen that has been found there. They've talked about the coins that would have rested on the eyes. What of the other evidences, what do you think are the most compelling? Give me one more.
Well, unfortunately, those two that you mentioned are not big on my list.
Yeah, that's okay. That's fine.
When we took tape samples from the shroud for our chemical analyses back in the United States, when I did our examination, the pollens were, we didn't really get much pollen residue, but yet others who took tape samples got quite a bit. And so I don't see what the difference is, why why we would not get hardly any, if at all. And the other sampling, using the same tape sampling method that we used, gets a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so until I can resolve that in my own mind, I'm not inclined to want to use that one way or the other.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Dr. Jackson, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Wonderful talking with you. And I appreciate your scrutiny and your commitment to handling the empirical evidence here so well. Thank you.
Yes, we have to get this right.
Yeah. I'm with you. Dr. John Jackson, Turin Shroud of Colorado.
Building the apostolate of the laity and leading in the new evangelization. Ave Maria Radio joins EWTN in spearheading the recovery of the American Catholic identity and equipping all Catholics to take co-responsibility for Christ's Church.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile. 5% of your mobile plan price goes to a pro-life or Catholic charity at no additional cost to you. More information can be found at CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
St. Mary in Rockwood is hosting an event, The Shroud of Turin, The Convergence of Faith and Science, or an Unholy Hoax. The event will be at 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 11, following the 6:30 Mass. The talk will focus on the scientific evidence performed on one of the most thoroughly studied ancient religious items. St. Mary's is located on Church Street in Rockwood. Call 734-379-9248 or email stmaryrockwood@sbcglobal.net.
I think I'm pregnant.
Really? What are you going to do?
What choice do I have?
She has a choice. It's ICUDetroit.com. Image clear ultrasound or ICU in the womb. We bring hope to women in need. And where there's hope, there are life-affirming choices. We are Michigan's first mobile ultrasound unit, servicing the Detroit metro area, providing free pregnancy tests, ultrasounds, and non-judgmental peer counseling. All services and care take place in our spacious mobile unit, which has a private exam room with a state-of-the-art 3D ultrasound and a separate lounge area for family or friends. If your church, congregation, or youth group is interested in learning more about this ministry, please call 248-620-5353 or visit us at ICUDetroit.com. That's the letters ICUDetroit.com or 248-620-5353. ICUDetroit.com.
You're invited to attend the 5th Annual AMU Southeast Michigan Scholarship Dinner Dance in honor of St. Joseph and St. Patrick, Saturday, March 7th in Ann Arbor. Come enjoy an evening of fine Irish and Polish fare and a silent auction as we raise funds for deserving students to attend Ave Maria University. Entertainment will be provided by the O'Hare Irish Dancers and Big Daddy Lakowski and the La-Di-Das. To attend or for more information, call the Ave Maria Foundation at 734-930-3587.
As Americans, we cherish freedom. Indeed, freedom, or liberty, is perhaps the defining principle of our Constitution and its Bill of Rights. But what precisely is freedom? St. John Paul II, in his timeless encyclical Veritatis Splendor, or The Splendor of Truth, tells us that the crucified Christ reveals the authentic meaning of freedom. This authentic freedom is total self-sacrifice to do the will of God. Indeed, Christ reveals, first and foremost, that the acceptance of truth is the condition for authentic freedom. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. His crucifixion reveals the unbreakable bond between freedom and truth. Conversely, totalitarianism arises out of a denial of truth in the objective sense. Thus, the root of modern totalitarianism is to be found in the denial of God. Today, we are witnessing a form of totalitarianism in the agenda of secular progressives, who call abortion choice, equate sexual perversion with the sacrament of marriage, and describe the Bible as hate speech. In the final analysis, authentic freedom is achieved by following God's will, and bondage is assured by its rejection. And so it is that the national motto of our free nation is, quite appropriately, In God We Trust. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website, liking us on Facebook, and following us on Twitter.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Many, many listeners grew up listening to that open to Star Trek. And my guest right now, Stephen Gradonis, will offer us some reflections on Star Trek, its incredibly influential impact on pop culture. And, of course, this is all initiated by the passing of Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock. Well, good to have you, Stephen. Thanks.
Al, it's good to be here.
Did you like Star Trek?
I did. I liked the original series.
When did it first air?
In the 1960s. Was it 1966? I don't remember the exact year that it started.
I don't recall either, but I remember I did not pay much attention to it, so I don't remember. It was later that I came to appreciate it. But
for me, Star Trek was a phenomenon of the reruns of the 1970s.
Okay.
That's when I saw it. I was only born in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And so I discovered it in reruns, and it was unlike anything else that was on television at the time, or unlike anything that had been. And then, of course, later on, after it was canceled, it only ran for three seasons, and they only produced 78 episodes, 79 if you count the pilot.
Is that so? It was only three seasons?
Only three, yeah.
Wow, that surprises me.
Yeah, it never did terribly well in the ratings. It wasn't until the reruns that it really began to develop a strong fan base.
That's wild. What a funny history. When did they decide to do the Next Generation?
That was, I think, in the early 80s.
Okay.
Gene Roddenberry had always wanted to revisit the world of Star Trek, and so he set it about a century after the original series. He updated the technology, and at first the Next Generation was really stiff. It was very ideological. It was very controlled by Gene Roddenberry's ideas of what he wanted Star Trek to be. And it really kind of loosened up and grew into itself starting around in the third season. In the third season and the fourth season, as Roddenberry was no longer as involved, he became sick, he died, and the showrunners took it in some other directions. And for the most part, I think some much better directions. The later part of the series is much better than the earlier.
Years ago, when I was on the air in Detroit, I enacted an interview with Gene Roddenberry using a guest. I didn't interview Roddenberry, but I had an interview of his in the Humanist magazine, and somebody sat across from me, and we played it back and forth. He was a pretty committed secular humanist, right?
He was.
Yeah, that's how I understood him, too.
And that it really shows in the show. The Star Trek is devoted. Star Trek is a utopian future. So it depicts what Roddenberry believes is an ideal future, and in many ways, it's a future that we as Catholics could agree with and support and try to work for. Some of it is a little too idealistic, and some of it is problematic. And one of the things that he thought that we would outgrow, along with racism and all kinds of other social problems, he thought that we would eventually outgrow religion.
That's right.
And that reason and science and cooperation would just lead mankind into an ideal future.
That's right.
That's obviously a problematic point of view, and it was not always the point of view represented in the show. There are some more positive treatments of religious themes even in the original series, and then particularly in the later series, as the show became a little franker about the realities of human nature, the complexities of human nature, religion crept back into the picture and was often treated more positively.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed in the culture generally that old style enlightenment exaltation of reason and this utopian future built on science is less popular than it once was, and there seems to be now a greater desire to kind of understand religion as part of our wiring and something that even if you're an atheist, you have to deal with the enduring quality of religion, both its positives and its negatives for culture. So,
and what's interesting about that is that it's actually a more humanistic approach.
Yes.
To religion. We are so accustomed to the term humanism having been claimed by the secular humanist.
Right.
If you're a humanist, then you're non-religious. But humanism is a term with roots in the Renaissance.
Absolutely.
The original Renaissance humanists were devoted to the study of the humanities, to human culture, grammar, rhetoric, history, poetry, moral philosophy. I'm talking about people like Erasmus and St. Thomas More, of the classical world, of antiquity. So as humanists, they wanted to offer a corrective to what they considered the narrow focus of medieval scholasticism on Christian scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So humanism is based on a confidence of the goodness of human nature created in God's image despite the effects of sin, and it's a recognition that truth is truth wherever you find it. So as Christians, we don't have a monopoly on insight or talent or virtue,
right.
And the early humanists greatly admired the rationalism of classical scholars.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to engage a broader world of thought and dialogue, and that's they brought that scholarship to the service of the church.
Yeah.
Secular humanism, by the way.
Very nicely said. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So as Christians, I think it's very important for us to push back on that and say, no, we're humanists too.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Absolutely. Kirk represents the kind of a broader. He's the alpha male, of course, but he's also represents a broader learning than, or more humane learning than Spock in this series.
With respect to human nature, that is true. One of the things that Star Trek does is it has a kind of a Gulliver's Travels approach to human nature, where particular planets and cultures and races all represent different facets of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so Spock represents logic and science and learning. Now, his character becomes more complicated as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
He develops this mystical side
right.
to him.
Right.
And so he becomes a kind of a backdoor into the Star Trek world for meditation and spirituality and ultimately for religion itself.
Mm-hmm.
But he also he's kind of religion in a sort of a Zen Buddhist mode.
That's right.
So he wants to suppress his emotions. At first we're told that he doesn't have any, but then we learn that he does. And at first we think it's because he's half human. But then it turns out that no Vulcans really have emotions. So the situation becomes much more complicated. But Spock represents a kind of atrophy of emotions or a dearth of emotions, and Kirk has a lot of fun goading him about that and pointing out that he's not really as emotionless as he seems.
That's right. How did the original cast of Star Trek see the impact of the show on popular culture? Were they aware of it, or when did it actually happen? If it was only a 3-season affair, when did it really hit us as like, hey, this is important?
I think that they knew it while the show was going on. I think it was very deliberate. What you had in Star Trek, and Roddenberry was very canny in setting this episode in the future. You know, you had Nichelle Nichols as Uhura. She was a regular cast member. She was black, and she was a woman, and she was right there on the bridge of the ship with all of the other most important characters. You could never have done that in the 1960s in a TV series set in the present day. People wouldn't have accepted it. But what Roddenberry did, which is exactly what Martin Luther King Jr. did in his I Have a Dream speech, was he projected his dream into the future. He said, this is what it may be like now, but if you think it's always going to be like that, you're not using your imagination. Think about what your children and your grandchildren and your great, think about how they're going to view the world. So he was able to do this, to imagine a ship in which all-American Kirk is sitting side by side with a Chinese comms officer,
right.
and a black communications officer, and later on we even get a Russian ensign. This is absolutely revolutionary. And of course Spock, Leonard Nimoy's character, although he's played by a Jewish American kid from New York, he also symbolically represents the other in its purest form, because he's an extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
And all, this is a very Catholic vision, you know.
Yes, it is. There's a universality
everyone, everybody coming
to it.
Together.
No, that universality. That's what I keep saying is we are the masters of real diversity here. Look at a World Youth Day and tell me any other festival around the world that looks like World Youth Day. The church is universal in its reach and in its ambitions. And so I never like to count us out when it comes to this embrace of universal humanity. And in Star Trek, it was even beyond humanity.
Indeed. And in the spirit of the Renaissance humanists, we should be willing to embrace that insight and that inclusiveness, even when we find it outside the bounds of Catholic orthodoxy.
Yeah. No, I agree. What was Leonard Nimoy like as a man?
My impression is that he was a mensch.
Yeah.
He was a decent, upstanding guy. One story that I just heard about him that I had never heard before. I think one of the other cast members, I think it was George Takei, discovered that he and some of his other male co-stars were being more highly paid than Nichelle Nichols. And for whatever reason, he took that news to, or he took that discovery to Leonard Nimoy, and Nimoy took it to the Studio Suits,
wow.
To the networks, and they raised her salary. You know, that was he was always gracious to fans. I have never heard a bad anecdote about him.
Wow. Was there tension between him and Kirk?
I think there was probably tension between William Shatner and most of his most of his co-stars. That's something that he's been kind of known for. But my impression is that they had a friendship that was real. Shatner also, incidentally, was Jewish. But what was different about Nimoy's character is that having that Jewish background gave him an experience of otherness, of alienation from the mainstream that he could draw on in representing Kirk. And he did bring his Jewishness to the character of Spock, rather.
Mm-hmm.
He did bring that to the character of Spock. One very famous example is the famous Vulcan salute, which he introduced on the show, which came from a Jewish priestly blessing in synagogue that he saw as a little boy, peeking at the blessing when he was supposed to have his head bowed. He also mitigated, I think, what would have otherwise been a much more of a Zen Buddhist kind of approach to Spock's spirituality with more of a Jewish kind of emphasis on the goodness of creation and human nature and of man created in God's image. For instance, it was Leonard Nimoy who came up with the idea that Vulcans were a tactile race. So when they want to read your mind, they have to touch your face because the body is real and the body matters and the body and the soul are connected. He also invented the Vulcan nerve pinch on the theory that Spock was too dignified to resort commonly to fisticuffs like Captain Kirk.
Hmm. Well, Stephen, how can people get a hold of you and tell us, is it still decentfilms.com with the new redesign?
It's decentfilms.com. The site has been completely redesigned.
Okay.
It's 100% better, so check it out.
I have been, and always shall be, your friend. Live long. And prosper.
What makes Advanced Dentistry Center unique? While all dentists preach comfort, Dr. Mahdi uses laser technology with many of his patients. The laser's precise work allows for faster healing on periodontal pockets and root canals while diminishing the risk for bacteria to linger, giving you and your family the results you want. Here's Dr. Mahdi.
Using laser for treating gum disease will reduce your chance of needing further treatment, like advanced gum surgeries, and also will increase your chance of saving your teeth for the rest of your life.
And Advanced Dentistry Center is one of the few places in the state that has it. Laser can also fix most cavities without a local anesthetic or shot. Learn about their services and get testimonials at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com. Located at 13 Mile and Telegraph. That's AdvancedDentistryCenter.com or call 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. Advanced Dentistry Center is a general practice who provides the most up-to-date treatments to help you look and feel your best.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Building the apostolate of the laity and leading in the new evangelization. Ave Maria Radio joins EWTN in spearheading the recovery of the American Catholic identity and equipping all Catholics to take co-responsibility for Christ Church.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile. 5% of your mobile plan price goes to a pro-life or Catholic charity at no additional cost to you. More information can be found at CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Get over to AveMariaRadio.net. I want you to take a look at commentary there. Love has no gender. Marriage does. It's a play on a popular video going around right now. But I'd like you to see it and also read the commentary. Love has no gender, marriage does. Tonight on EWTN, we've got Raymond Arroyo with Bill Donahue, president of the Catholic League, and also George Schwartz, chairman and CEO of Schwartz Investment Counsel and manager of the Ave Maria Mutual Fund Family, will be there on Raymond's program the world over. And tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon, Paul Darrow, a well-known model, a man of hedonism, finally realizes that his homosexuality won't suit him for eternity. We'll talk about his conversion. That's tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is produced and distributed by Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and presented by the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. The executive producer is Nick Tom. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, your national and local online business directory, connecting Christian business professionals with Catholic consumers. Advertisers have taken a stand to support Christian family values in the marketplace. It's important to support businesses that embrace life and promote the gospel of Christ. And at CatholicBusinessPages.com, business professionals have taken that stand. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Republicans, Democrats, no matter which political party is in office, there are always investment opportunities to be found. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds won't compromise the moral beliefs of its investors. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. The portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and moral values. Call toll-free 866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing.